I'm Coley Hoffman, and I'm from a lot of places, but right now I live in Millbrook, New York, and will soon be a resident of Portland, Oregon, which should involve a lot of transition and umbrellas.
Could you tell me a little bit about your work?
Yes and no. I mean, I'll tell you what I know, but I wish it could talk for itself. Because, you know, I can say things like, I'm writing this book about the history of medicine. But what the poems are saying are things like, oh my God, not another delusion. Why do you keep putting leeches on me? Will someone please hold my hand? You know, everyone here is crazy. So, process-wise, what I've been doing at Ledig, I came here to quote-unquote work on a book about the history of medicine, and I did some of that. But I think I got a little bit excited about the research part, which I've not done a lot of for poetry. You know, usually I have, you know, imaginary idea X, and I just go through and see where it takes me, and, you know, and then maybe have to look up a fact here or there. And this, I was looking up all these facts, and then I tried to write poems, and they sucked. So I realized that it had to be the other way around, that I could read the stuff, and that was sure fun, but the crux of it had to be still what I do, which is 95% imaginary, and then throw some facts in as necessary here and there, or use a fact for inspiration.
What drew you to the history of medicine?
Gosh. Partly to find a justification for why I am inappropriately obsessed with things like leeches and why people want to drill holes in their head to get rid of mental illness 500 years ago. And all those hours add up to a lot of Wikipedia. And, you know, I felt like I had to make something out of that. And then, but on a more, you know, real level in my soul, I've kind of grown up around medicine and illness my whole life. Like, my sister and I were always sick growing up, and my mom's a nurse, and then now that we're grown, my brother is a doctor, and my dad is in long-term care, and my sister and I are still sick all the time. So I guess in the past couple of years, I've been going through more of an odyssey with the healthcare system, and it started making me realize, you know, like, are the treatments that we're doing now that we think are, you know, the scientific cutting edge, they were doing treatments 500 years ago that they also thought were the scientific cutting edge, and now we're, you know, we think those people are barbarians. So I wonder what we're doing now that people are going to think it is barbaric. I think all of this basically coalesced when I take the train to New York a lot, and I was on the Harlem line once, and there's this stop at Harlem Valley Wingdale where there's an abandoned insane asylum. And at the time, it used to be a cutting edge, you know, they had all the latest treatments, like in the 40s maybe.
All the latest built.
Yeah, yeah. They pump you full of insulin and put you in a coma. And now, you know, it's crumbled and fallen to bits, and nobody stays in a hospital for more than a week unless they're actually dangerous. The paper one. It helps to understand there were two realities, and words were in the paper one. The other was made of clouds, and sometimes whatever animals or feelings clouds made with their shapes. The cloud world had giant one-way windows. You couldn't see inside, and it was very, very dark out. Your own face sent out a search party for you. The limitations of our brains and other body parts rapped on the glass as we danced. I could never tell which was you and which was me, and if that simple touch was some girl's thighs or the wings of a moth. The paper world had words available, but none were the right ones. Later at the bonfire, people threw all the words in, and soon the entire world burned down. Afterward, we kept talking, but one of us kept glancing at something over the other person's head. You said it was to watch for predators. I said, "What's predators?" You made a cloud with your index finger in the shape of a person whose language had words for every complicated feeling. I made the shape of that person's internal organs and started an electrical storm that would never stop.
I'm V. Ramaswamy from Calcutta in India, and I'm a literary translator translating from Bengali to English.
The first translation that you did was the Golden Gandhi statue from America. Could you explain a little bit of the history of that translation?
It happened entirely by chance when just in a bar room conversation with a friend, this name came up as a writer in Bengali who was perhaps the only one worth reading. A friend told me that, and so I said, I'll translate him. But that happened in terms of work, because that man kept pushing me, you know. And so I got off my back and began to translate. And then soon in that process, I became a serious translator of this untranslated, obscure writer. And so I've set myself a long-term target of translating a good representation of his short fiction, which is more accessible to non-Bengali readers.
Could you tell me his name?
Subimal Misra. He is a fiercely independent kind of man. He did not write for any mainstream publication or publisher. He published his own books and wrote only in small literary magazines of limited circulation, and of a fiercely anti-establishment nature and questioning nature, and deeply critical of the social mores in his society, which is Bengal, middle-class Bengali gentlemen and their mental and psychological and social makeup. He just lays it bare in a very brutal way.
There was one piece that was all sort of surrounded by dreams.
Right.
And that piece I found really spectacular in the sense that it was about him saying, if I don't dream, I walk around aimless. But if I dream, no matter how gory it is, I feel alive, essentially.
Something like that.
Could you talk a little bit about that piece?
He's just, I think, looking microscopically at the functioning of the mind. Say if somebody is lying awake in bed late at night, you know, and just observing the way his mind goes, and he doesn't rein in anything, the directions it goes, and with attendant, you know, feelings either of elation or of fear and so on. So he's very taken by the language of cinema, and his agenda, as it were, in his writing was to bring the language of cinema and Jean-Luc Godard's cinema into Bengali literature and to go away from conventional narrative style of writing and have a cinematic expression. So his stories read like watching something in front of you on the screen. There are scenes and there are it's a montage. Sequence of apparently unrelated shots, but there is a relation, inner relation in your mind between those. So, and he challenges you to go through that experience.
I also would love to ask you a little bit about the relationship between emotions and translating that into a foreign language.
One thing I might talk about, which I deal with many languages, is and from my emotions, which are sacred songs, texts from different religions and in different languages, mainly old languages. Some of them are dead now, like Latin or Sanskrit or Pali and so on. So different circumstances and events in my life have taken me to particular texts. Of course, there was an underlying interest in it. And I would pick up particular verses from them and set them to melody and learn it in the original language and then sing it. So it's a personal kind of hobby, you might say. It is completely emotional, and my emotions have drawn me to it. For instance, I came across a verse by the Buddhist monk of the 6th century called Shantideva. So he has written a kind of primer for the Buddhist monk on the kind of heart and vision of a Buddhist monk. So there's a verse in that about not being self-centered, not being selfish, but being other-minded with as much zeal and fervor as you are self-minded. So that's a personal, emotional venture with foreign languages.
Can I make a wish? The lullaby. I love that song.
She's referring to what I called a pedagogical lullaby. And it's in Bengali. That's the language I translate from, and commonly I conduct my life in that language. But I work in a slum in Howrah, which is across the river from Calcutta, for many years. And in my early days there, I composed this. But the people there are not Bengali speaking, they are Urdu speaking. But the song came spontaneously within me in Bengali. And I thought just those people, Urdu-speaking children and women activists, could learn this song and they would like to learn it and sing it and would appreciate the values contained in that song. So it just came to me like in a flash, this whole song in Bengali. So it says, little boy, little girl, you have to work hard, you have to walk a great deal, but your mother's love will be with you like body armor, and you have to learn to read and write. By coming into the light, you shall be able to help others to come into the light. And if you learn how to read, then you will be able to read your own destiny and write your own destiny as well. And you should be clean in mind and body, and you should be brave. And when you fall down, you shouldn't worry, because your mother's love is surrounding you like body armor. So that's the message. Khoka khuki shikte hobe khatte hobe tomake maera dur kobuch hoye shonge tomar thakbe nayon moni nijer paaye hatte hobe tomake shoja pathe matha tule চলতে হবে তোমাকে লেখা পড়া শিখলে তুমি মানুষ হতেই পারবে আলো এসে আলো তোমার আলো দিতেই থাকবে পড়তে শেখো জীবনকেও পড়তে তুমি পারবে লিখতে গিয়ে নিজে জীবন নিজেই তুমি লিখবে পরিচ্ছন্ন রাখবে তুমি শরীর আর মনটাকে সুস্থ স্বাস্থ্য মনে প্রাণে মানুষ ওকেই কয় হাঁটতে গেলে আচার খেয়ে ব্যথা হবে মাঝে মাঝে মায়ের কবচ প্রতিক্ষণে থাকবে তোমার সনে মায়ের কবচ প্রতিক্ষণে থাকবে তোমার সনে
I'm Mathilde Walter Clark. I'm from Denmark. I live in Copenhagen and I write mainly novels and short stories and also essays and weird kind of non-genre things. As a kid, when I visited the States, I'm half American, I just remember this shocking experience of all my usual kind of jokes or sense of humor did completely not work in English. It was just not working. No expression from other people. And I kind of kind of had to invent a sense of humor that kind of went into that culture and language.
And have a lot of your books been translated, or have they stayed in the Danish language?
Some of my books are translated into Norwegian. and then I have had short stories in various American journals, and then parts of my novels translated into English there online. But
do you always write in Danish, or do you ever start in English?
The piece I wrote that I read from in the winery on Friday, I wrote in English.
That was a great piece.
But otherwise, I usually write in Danish because it's my first language, and this piece that I wrote in English, it felt natural to write in English because I was in an English speaking environment and it's so simply written. Mm. But otherwise, I think it would be hard for me to write something in not my own language, because it's not what first comes to mind, so it doesn't really come natural, and it's an extra fact. I almost have to kind of make it up, and as soon as you start having that feeling of having to make things up as you write, it becomes difficult. Mm-hmm. It should just kind of flow, and this is much easier if you don't think about the language.
Would you mind telling me a little bit about the piece that you wrote while on a plane?
Yes. I was invited to Hong Kong. They were looking to invite authors from Europe, and I got this email just one day: would I like to be invited to Hong Kong for a month? Of course I said yes, thinking it would be a writer's residency, a little bit like this one, where you could be provided a space and sit and write. And then when I came up there, it turned out that it was anything not like that. It was completely like lost in translation. It was just this complete tunnel of not understanding anything. Attending a lot of dinners we didn't understand, and yeah. And then I wrote this piece on one of the trips we made. It was from Beijing back to Hong Kong, and it's about a group of writers going to Hong Kong, especially one Dr. Squara. And it's called Friendship Hotel. Dr. Squara Goes to China. I should say it's a book, it's an illustrated children's books for grown-ups. And it's a book about East and West Europe and China, traveling, cash machines, credit cards, gambling, faxes, graves, mistresses, languages, friendship, and many other interesting and grown-up things. Friendship Hotel. Dr. Squara is a poet from Austria. He has been invited by some people from Hong Kong to come and stay in a hotel with a group of other writers from Europe. The other writers come from many places. There's a poet from Finland. There's a poet from Norway. There's a poet from Germany. There's a poet from Denmark. And a poet from Russia. But Dr. Squara is the only poet from Austria. The people from Hong Kong think of the writers as a group. They think they're all writers. They're all from Europe, so they are a group. The people from Hong Kong even have a theme: writers from Europe. This is an error. They don't realize that Dr. Squara is an Austrian poet. He's an individual and does not belong to a group. When Dr. Squara is not invited to Hong Kong to stay in a hotel with other European writers, he teaches at a university in San Diego. He tries to teach culture to the American people. This, of course, is impossible. Dr. Squara knows this very well and makes sure that everybody else knows it too. Dr. Squara prefers to speak German, of course. He speaks English very well, but he's against the English language. So he tries very hard to keep his German accent. A small protest, but nevertheless a protest. Every night, Dr. Squara smokes his cigar. A nice Cuban cigar. Some of the other writers in Hong Kong don't like cigar smoke. So Dr. Squara sits for himself and smokes his cigar. This is all right, Dr. Squara thinks. He's an individual. He does not belong to a group. Dr. Squire has brought many important things with him from Europe to Hong Kong. A very expensive Longshin watch, a very expensive Montblanc fountain pen, a very expensive Dupont lighter, and a walking stick from London. In Hong Kong, Dr. Squire keeps himself very busy with the things he brought from Europe. The expensive Longshin watch is broken. The expensive fountain pen is broken. The Dupont lighter doesn't work properly. And the walking stick is too short. So in Hong Kong, Dr. Squire goes to many shops to fix the broken things. In the shops, they make phone calls to Europe to get the missing parts so they can fix Dr. Squire's things. They're all very nice to Dr. Squire. The only thing that cannot be fixed in Hong Kong is the walking stick. The shop which sold it to Dr. Squire in London insisted it was just perfect, not too short and not too long. But it is too short, and so it cannot be fixed. In Hong Kong, Dr. Squire goes on a trip to Macau. In Macau, they have lots of casinos. He goes there all by himself. He's an individual and does not belong to a group. Dr. Squire likes to lose money in the casino. It makes him feel good. In fact, he prefers it to winning. Winning makes him feel guilty. It's all very complicated. He's a poet from Austria, you see. In the casinos in Macau, he loses a lot of money. So he goes to the cash machine to get some more money to lose. He puts his credit card in the machine, and the machine spits out banknotes 1, 2, 3. 3,000 Hong Kong dollars. Dr. Squire is very happy. He takes the money and goes back into the casino to lose them, but he forgets to take his credit card. When you forget your credit card in the machine swallows it. So when he returns, the credit card is stuck in the belly of the machine. The machine is made like that. It is all very strange and not like in Europe. So now Dr. Squire has no credit card. He's unable to lose more money and has no choice but to return to Hong Kong. When Dr. Squire returns to Hong Kong, the other writers ask him many questions. Where have you been? How much money did you lose? And where is your credit card? Dr. Squire explains to the other writers what happened in Macau. I lost a lot of money, so I am very happy. But now I don't have a credit card. This is very inconvenient. Now I have to call the bank in Austria so they can send me a new one. The bank in Austria asks Dr. Squire to send a fax. But before he has a chance to send the fax, the people from Hong Kong want to take all the writers on a trip to Beijing. Beijing is in China. Hong Kong is in China too, but a different kind of China. In Beijing, they don't know what a fax is. This is very inconvenient for Dr. Squire. Dr. Squire doesn't want to go to Beijing. He wants to send his fax, not to go to Beijing. Traveling is difficult. In the airport, they ask travelers to take off their belts and sometimes their shoes. Dr. Squire uses many trays for all his things. One for his very expensive Longshin watch, one for his very expensive Montblanc fountain pen, one for his very expensive Dupont lighter, and one for his Cuban cigar. But he makes sure to keep his wallet in his pocket. When he goes through the security check, they always insist on fondling Dr. Squire up. Dr. Squire likes this, especially if they are Puritan Americans. In this case, they are shy Chinese. He tells the security guards that he likes being fondled just to see their reaction. But afterwards, he says, traveling is very difficult. In Beijing, the writers are to stay in a hotel. Each writer gets their own room. Dr. Squarra's room has a window. But it turns out it's not a real window. It's facing a wall. The wall is 10 centimeters from the window. So in effect, the room has four walls, but no window. In Dr. Squarra's room, there's no toilet paper. The room is very cold, 14 degrees Celsius. And there's a mosquito in the room. It's not really a room, Dr. Squarra thinks to himself. It is a grave. How to use a toilet without toilet paper? Of course, he could use the fax for the bank in Austria. But Dr. Squarra will not do that. He will not give in to barbarianism. So this is what I have. It's about a fourth of the story, so it would be long to read the whole thing.
Rama, Matilda, Colleen?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Monday afternoon show, WGXC.
Thank you.
Thank you for
having us.
Yeah.